You are being recorded, and I need to ask you if you consent to be recorded today.
Yes.
So the date is July 2nd, 2024. The location is the Archives and Special Collections located at the Strom Thurmond Institute on my end. And where is your location at today?
I'm at 499 South Capitol Street, Washington, D.C., just a few blocks from the Capitol, which you might be able to see behind me.
Yeah. And then could you just state your full name for me as well?
Yes, John Allen Martin.
Okay. And then this project is going to be for the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Political Science Department at Clemson University, and the interviews are held on Zoom today. And then, so let's just get started with the interview. So we're going to start with our just general personal questions. So when and where were you born, Mr. Allen?
I was born in Anderson, South Carolina, June 19, 1947.
And then where did you grow up? And did
I grew
that
up
change
there as well.
At any point?
Yeah, I grew up there as well. Went to grammar school, junior high and high school in Anderson. I actually was the first integrated class, and by that I mean boys and girls, because Anderson had the public school, high schools were divided. There was a girls' high school and a boys' high school. They combined my freshman year in high school. So I was actually in the first class that went through high school with boys and girls together.
And what was your favorite, like, academic subject growing up throughout primary, grammar, and all of that?
Well, I had a lot of interest. I loved learning. I was very interested in current events and history, loved math, foreign languages, had Latin in junior high, French in high school, some German. My father actually purchased the great books of the Western world, if you're familiar with those. So I read those voraciously, from Aristotle to Plato to John Locke to Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, The Foundations of Capitalism, all the way up to current thinkers. So in addition to my academic learning in school, I did a lot of reading of those great books. My father took U.S. News and World Report and the Wall Street Journal, which I read, you know, pretty voraciously every edition that that came out. I will interject here that I think my father had the greatest influence on me growing up. He was a 1939 graduate of Clemson. That famous class, he was in the 101st Airborne Division. He was in the 4th plane to go into France the night before D-Day. He made 20 jumps behind enemy lines and was one of the few in the 101st Airborne that survived. He thought that he had been spared for a reason. So he was very dedicated to his faith, to his family, and to his business. He was an entrepreneur. His father had started his 4 brothers in their own business, and my father did the same. He started his 4 brothers and his brother-in-law in the businesses of their own. So I grew up in a family that was talking about business, free enterprise. We were quite competitive. He never really was overbearing in terms of grades, but he had a way of leaving unsaid that he expected us to do well. So we all did well in school. When it came time to go to college, I applied to Duke, to Emory, and to Clemson, got into all 3, and decided to go to Clemson, even though he was not particularly forceful in encouraging me to go to Clemson. He wanted me to make my own decision.
And I guess that kind of leads into the other question that I have. Was there a specific time in school that made you feel like college was the best fit? And I know you just mentioned your father being a big influence in that as well, but was there a specific, like, anecdote that made you feel like college was the best fit for you?
Not really. It was just kind of expected. It was the next step in life. I had a brother that was born before the war, who was already at Clemson. And, so he kind of, it was kind of comical in that he said that he could get me into his dorm as a freshman. And so I was very excited about that. And my best friend and I moved into his dorm only to find out that we were the only freshmen in that dorm. His father was killed in an automobile accident several weeks after we got to school and he moved out. And so Clemson at the time was a military school, and much to my chagrin, I would wake up every morning with a line of boots and buckles to shine. And so it turned out to be not a very good thing.
Yeah. Alrighty. And then just the last one about like childhood and general personal questions. Could you describe like what your general career goals were, like what influenced these goals, how you felt so drawn to them?
I never really thought about that. I thought probably that I would start a business of my own. I thought, you know, from your questions as to how my interest in politics started, and I really can't remember, because it started at an early age. I can remember in the fourth grade, debating for Dwight Eisenhower, against a good friend of mine. She represented, Adlai Stevenson. And so that was kind of my first recollection. I had an eighth grade teacher, who shared my, interest in free enterprise and, Republican politics, even though then there were no Republicans in South Carolina. But she was very encouraging, and I was very active in the 1960 campaign. And of course was very disappointed in the outcome. And she brought a TV into school for us to watch the inauguration. And I was very chagrined and didn't want to watch it. And she forced me to watch that and really taught me a very valuable lesson that once campaigns are over, that, you know, politicians should represent all of the people, including those that didn't vote for them. So that was a very valuable lesson that I learned in eighth grade. But I participated in all the campaigns. Back then, since there were no Republicans, we always supported the conservative Democrat when there was a contest. And then in high school, Republicans did start running candidates, and I was heavily involved in every campaign every 2 years.
So after you had that early start in politics, was that your original intention with Clemson? Was it originally to take as many political science courses as you wanted, or?
No, I didn't really think that was possible. I just thought it was a civic duty that everybody should be involved in politics. I really, you know, had no idea that you could do that as a vocation, that there were jobs in politics. And really at that time there weren't any, and there certainly were none for Republicans. Another really critical event in my life was that, the Klan was after us for being Republicans. We came home from church one night and there was a 7-foot cross burning in our yard. So we went through months and years where the Klan was trying to drive us out of Anderson. The sheriff was the head of the Klan, so we had no redress, to the legal system. My father also was head of the hospital board, and when they first integrated, he probably also was the largest employer of blacks in Anderson. So there were a lot of things that went into it, but the Klan at that time kind of was okay with Northerners who had moved south and were Republicans, but they really couldn't tolerate longtime native Southern families like we were, who were conservative and Republicans. And so that was quite startling, to my brothers and sister and I, that because we would walk to school and they would drive along beside us and yell cuss words at us, and they would call us, you know, night and day and threaten us. So that was, quite a scary introduction. My father, though, was a pillar of strength, and thank goodness, he was an industrial roofer, and so he roofed big plants from Texas to Virginia. So he didn't depend on Anderson for his livelihood. I think had he been dependent on Anderson, you know, they probably would have driven us out. But he was very committed to being strong, to not being intimidated. I can remember, you know, when we discussed integration, which was happening at the time, he was very adamant that we were not to participate in violence, that everybody was individual and of worth, and you know, that blacks were just as capable and as worthy as we were. And looking back on it, I'm very proud of the way Clemson integrated, that we did peacefully. I think it kind of underscores the culture of Clemson, that we've always valued critical thinking, that we've always been respectful of people that disagree with us, and that we, you know, settle our differences respectfully and humanely. And that was something that I learned at a very early age. And it's one of the reasons I've stayed involved with Clemson, so, because I think our culture, particularly in today's world, is something that we need to preserve. And so I've tried my best to stay involved with Clemson and maintain that culture of valuing critical thinking.
And then just to clarify, what year did you start attending Clemson, and then what year did you graduate?
Started in 65 and finished in 69.
And then what was your initial major, and did that change at all before you graduated?
My major was history. I finished in history. There was no political science major then. I took every political science course that was offered and minored in political science and French. Probably had there been a poli-sci major, I would have majored in that, although I did somewhat consider it a throwaway major. You know, I didn't think that it would lead to anything.
And did you attend any other university or college at all after the fact?
I went to the University of South Carolina after graduation, and got all the way through all my coursework. The only thing I lacked was my dissertation, and I didn't finish that because I was offered a job in politics. I went to school while I worked at what was then South Carolina Electric and Gas, which now is Dominion Energy, and I was in computer science there, and, you know, continued my volunteer work, which, you know, I was president of the Teenage Republicans in Anderson. I was very involved with college Republicans at Clemson. When I moved to Columbia, I was very active. And so the South Carolina Republican Party offered me a job, and, you know, I was blown away because, again, I didn't think there were any jobs in politics. So I went to work for the state party, and then I became the first legislative assistant for the first 11 Republicans in the General Assembly. Then I was very involved in Jim Edwards' campaign for governor in 1974. I think I've sent to you that after he was elected, he awarded me the Order of the Palmetto. I think I may still be the youngest person to ever receive that recommendation. And then, because of that, Louisiana was trying to elect a Republican governor, and so they hired me as the executive director, and I moved to Baton Rouge. Learned another interesting lesson from my father at that point, because it seemed like Baton Rouge was the end of the world, and I really wanted to someday come to Washington at that point. And he said, Alan, you know, sometimes the shortest distance between two points is not always a straight line. And in fact, that proved to be the case with me. I did come back briefly and run Bobby Richardson's race for Congress. lived in Rock Hill for a time and then went back to Louisiana. It was kind of interesting because that was 1976 and the party leadership in South Carolina got together with the party leadership in Louisiana and they were trying to decide who has the best chance of winning. Is it Bob Livingston or Bobby Richardson? And so they determined it was Bobby Richardson. So I came back to South Carolina, managed that race. He lost very narrowly, had it stolen from him. Bob Livingston lost in a very close race, had it stolen from him. But the congressman who defeated Bob Livingston was sworn in January and he was indicted in May. And so there ended up being a special election and I was the natural fit to be the campaign manager. And so I managed his race and he won in a special election of 1977.
Would you say that special election in 1977 was kind of a turning point for you career wise where you were kind of put?
Well, not only was it a turning point for me, but it was kind of a turning point for Republicans because Jimmy Carter had just been elected president. And of course he was a Southerner. And so everybody said, that a Republican couldn't win in the midst of that. And there had never been a Republican in that district. It was 40% black. It was very much urban New Orleans. And so everybody said it couldn't be done. And we did it. And so it was pretty historic, in a lot of different ways. It was a definite turning point. And he, after we were successful, asked me to come to D.C. and be his chief of staff, which I did and served as his chief of staff for his entire career. And of course, we had some historic, we had the Republican takeover, the contract with America, which we helped write. We were on the Appropriations Committee, but we were seventh in seniority. And Newt jumped over all the old bulls because he was afraid that they were too ingrained and wouldn't do the necessary cuts to balance the budget, which we had committed to do in the Contract for America. And so very unexpectedly, we became chairman of the Appropriations Committee and went on to balance the budget for the first time in 40 years. And the last time the budget's been balanced. So that was quite a ride during those years. Well, interestingly enough, during that time, I had been to Iraq several times. And when I went there in 1992 and came back, I got very ill. And the doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And so I spent about a year getting sicker and sicker, still being chief of staff. And, of course, this was right before the 94 takeover. They eventually came to the diagnosis that I had hairy cell leukemia, which was caused by a toxic exposure. So they started asking me where I had been. When they found out I had been in Iraq and been with Saddam Hussein, they started asking me if I, what I'd eaten, if I had noticed any radiation or any kind of exposure. And so the thought is that Saddam may have given me my hairy cell leukemia. So I immediately went into chemo and was in ICU for quite a while and was touch and go, which, was a great regret on my part because it was such an interesting time in Congress. I was chief of staff to the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. So it was a very inopportune time, but it's kind of a weird, happening. Saddam Hussein had several doubles and we never knew when we met with him whether we were actually meeting with Saddam Hussein or whether it was one of his doubles. And I don't think we'll ever know for sure, what happened, but it's kind of a weird circumstance that, you know, occurred in those days.
Definitely something that you can think back on for sure. And just going back to like your time at Clemson as well, can you recall like the first political science course you took at Clemson, or was there a specific one that was most standout-ish to you now as you look back?
You know, I don't. And I think I could say the same thing about my history classes. And of course, I took a lot. I do remember the famous Professor Jerry Reel, who was a history professor for years. He also has done a lot of history of Clemson. We've had him in D.C. to speak to our club up here. We had one event. You probably know Thomas Green. Clemson originally was from Pennsylvania. And so he has relatives still alive there. And in one of our events, we had his relatives in Pennsylvania come down and present some Thomas Green Clemson documents to Jerry Reel, who was here. And so I thoroughly enjoyed all the Jerry Reel courses. He was big in terms of Western civilization, which unfortunately I don't think they teach much anymore. But he was just a great professor, and I took every course that he gave. And I think, quite frankly, it was, you know, one of the only few C's I ever received in college, because he was a strict grader, and he expected you to memorize a lot of facts and figures. And I was much more into modern history than I was ancient history and Western civilization. But I just thought that he was an excellent professor, and I wanted to learn as much as I could from him.
Would you say there was a professor or a course that you recall the most in your career now? Is there something that you call back to a lot, or a specific topic in political science that you think is most relevant to what you do now?
Well, Paige, it probably was too long ago. I do, you know, I do very much value our Republican form of government. I've studied, you know, the French Revolution and some of the pure democracies in the world, and very much value the fact that we have a republic rather than a democracy. I think it was a genius that our founders set up the checks and balances so that we aren't swayed by the majority, and that we don't suffer, you know, the consequences that happened in the French Revolution. I just think the wisdom of our founding fathers has served us so brilliantly, and that our free market economy. I've traveled extensively in my career, and a lot to developing countries. I've represented probably 18 foreign nations in my career, and I really think that our economic system is our strongest foreign policy weapon. And I regret the fact that more nations in the world haven't adopted our free market economy, because it has brought more wealth to more people than any country that's ever existed in world history.
So would you say that your career lines up pretty, I wouldn't say strictly, but relatively strictly to what you believed that you wanted to do in politics after you got out of Clemson, when you first got that job in the Republican Party when you were staying in Columbia?
Yeah. Yeah, I would. It's been a pretty linear line. And I've just thoroughly enjoyed traveling all over the country. I've been to all 50 states, worked in many of them, been all over the world. And like I say, had some really unique experiences. And met some outstanding, you know, individuals. I'm very indebted to Ronald Reagan, and I was very close to him and had an opportunity to work closely with him. I tend to consider myself, you know, more a Ronald Reagan, Republican, in the sense that, his demeanor is more mine. You know, he tends to be a very strong, person, but also a velvet glove. I'm very close to Tim Scott. I've been a big supporter of his since he was on Charleston County Council. And so I think that's more my nature, you know, Tim Scott and Ronald Reagan, that kind of soft-spoken, determined strength, you know, you don't misinterpret it as weakness. But it's just a velvet glove approach, which, you know, I think is more my approach and kind of descriptive of my nature.
Have you recently returned to Clemson's campus at all? And if you have recently, would you mind just talking a little bit about that experience, comparing it to when you were on campus?
Oh, I'm back all the time. I served on the Alumni Association Board of Directors. I was on the CUF board for, what, 6 or 8 years. I'm now on the Order of the Oak. I mentor probably 10 or 15 students a semester. I'm very much into the Institute for the Study of Capitalism. I'm very active with the new Launchpad. I'm very encouraging of entrepreneurs, of people that, you know, that have ideas that they want to generate into businesses. I help, you know, lots of students. I always hire Clemson interns. Many of them I encourage to invest, and I have an investment club for Clemson students and former students. We have a call every Monday at 1 o'clock. For many of them, I set them up in a Robinhood account. For some of them, the brightest, I loan them $1,000 if they don't have the money to do it, to set up an investment account. They are very excited of late because, 2 or 3 years ago, we bought NVIDIA at $200 a share. It went to $1,200 and split 10 for one. So they're making lots of money. And so they're very participatory of the investment club. And I follow them. I'm very involved with student government. They always come to D.C. once a week, and I host them in my office. And I follow them after they graduate. I guess it was 2 weeks ago, the Order of the Oak spotlighted me and my mentorship, and I had five of the students participate in that and tell, you know, how I helped them in undergraduate school, and then after they graduated, helped them get jobs and that sort of thing. And then I had one that I'm particularly close to, a kid from the Congo, who lived in Northern Virginia, and when he was in high school, he had his heart set on coming to Clemson and playing for Dabo. And so he wanted me to help him get in, and I don't know if you know it, but this year we had 55,000 out-of-state applications for 1,700 spots. So it's just, you know, you can't get into Clemson from out-of-state unless you're near genius. So I started writing letters to the president, to David Kuskowski, who's head of admissions, and I was able to get this kid from the Congo into the Bridge program. He came and he flourished, and then, you know, got regular admission. He tried to walk on for Dabo. He didn't make it. He came up with this idea for an exercise app, and I helped him develop that. He got an investor, and so he's trying to commercialize that now. He tried to walk on a second time and didn't make it, and so this past spring, he said, "Alan, this is my last chance. You know, what can I do?" And so I said, "Write Dabo a letter and tell him your story." So he wrote this letter about coming to the United States when he was 13, that, you know, he didn't speak any English, but he's so grateful to America and for the opportunities that it's given him, and that he's, you know, just so cherishes being here with all of the opportunities that it presents. And he had his heart set on playing for Dabo. And Dabo called him in front of his whole staff and read the letter, and he made the team. And so my wife and I came for the spring game, and he got in and made a tackle, And so we went down on the field after it was over, and of course it was a mob scene. So I told my wife, stand under the goal line and I'll go find Philippe. And so I was going through the mob and I looked and he was standing away from the crowd and I could tell he was looking for me. And we just embraced each other. It was the biggest hug. I was just so proud of that kid. So that's what I value the most now is, you know, is mentoring kids at Clemson and helping them do well and establish themselves in a career.
I mean, definitely giving back to the university that, you know, got you started to where you wanted to be is probably most important. I agree with that. And then I have just a couple more questions and then I'll ask you at the end if there's anything else that you'd like to add as well. What do you think Clemson has in store for its future, like regarding, you know, the growing political science, its research or any other aspects you think it's like leading towards future career wise, anything like that?
Well, I like to tell the story that when I was there, you know, there were 6,500 students, and I often heard my classmates over the years lament how we were growing, and they feared that as we grew that the culture would change. But I very strongly believe that, you know, in the more than 50 years since I graduated, it's remained, to use Reagan's term, the bright city on the hill. The culture has been maintained. Much of that I give credit to Jim Barker and Jim Clements, who have recognized our culture and who have helped maintain it. In the most recent years, with this crazy woke consensus and, you know, this growing violence and anti-Semitism that has invested the Ivies in so many schools around the country, I think that's resulted in the brand increase that we've had. When I first came to D.C., people didn't know where Clemson was. Now everybody knows where it is. They respect, you know, the education that we give and the graduates that come out of Clemson. And my wife is a Penn State graduate, and I'm on some of the same boards in State College that I am at Clemson. And so it's given me a neat perspective to compare. And most schools around the country are having trouble with enrollment because with the decrease in the birth rate, there are fewer and fewer college-age kids, and many universities are having trouble maintaining their enrollment. Just the opposite is the case with Clemson. I mean, the demand for a Clemson degree has never been greater. As I said, 55,000 out-of-state applications for 1,700 spots. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And I know the kids that we're getting from the D.C. area are just amazing. I mean, they're just absolutely incredible. I couldn't be more excited about the quality of the people that we're getting. And I try to convey to all the alums that they need to get involved because we all need to be committed to maintaining that culture that is so necessary to maintain, you know, a country like ours. And I really do think it remains a bright city on the hill, you know, has not changed, and I hope it never changes.
Given where you are, this is just kind of my personal interest. Given where you are now in your career, would you say that you are experiencing a lot of political science undergrads and other undergrads from Clemson coming up to doing kind of the same things that you're doing now and that they're following kind of similar career paths or?
Well, I do, and I love placing them in congressional offices. I can't tell you. I can't count the number of kids who've graduated, and I've been able to help them get jobs. You know, one of them is the chief of staff for a Nebraska senator. There's several that are chiefs of staff and deputy chiefs of staff to congressmen from all over the country. I have from August to January, I have a first Thursday football lunch for Clemson alums on the Hill. And since I'm only two blocks away, you know, it's easy for them to come. And so it's a way for me to keep up with them. And I just love doing that. And they're just outstanding. I mean, they've done, you know, such great jobs. And the Hill is a, you know, a fascinating, interesting place to work. Sometimes it's not, you know, very long lasting, because they stand for election every 2 years or a senator every 6 years. But still in all, it's a passport to, you know, a lot of very interesting jobs. So, yeah, I love placing kids in congressional offices and helping them do and, you know, following my footsteps.
All right. Well, that's all the prepared questions that I have today. But if there's anything else that you'd like to add, we can totally put that into our recording as well. So if there's anything I didn't touch upon or any anecdotes you'd like to share.
Well, only a couple of things. I mentioned to you that I also represent Muammar Gaddafi. We got a call in 2008 from Colin Powell, who was Secretary of Defense at the time. And this was right after we had invaded Iraq. And he said they had been contacted by Gaddafi because he was afraid that Libya was going to be next. And he wanted to give up his weapons of mass destruction. And would we represent him while we were trying to get those weapons of mass destruction out of Libya? Gaddafi spoke no English, but he had 9 sons, one of whom, Saif Gaddafi, had been educated at London School of Economics and spoke English. So he was our go-between to represent them. We found a ship that had offloaded in Alexandria, Egypt, and was headed back to the United States empty. We diverted it to Tripoli. All of Libya's weapons of mass destruction were loaded onto this ship. The captain and the people on the ship had no idea what their cargo was. It set sail from Tripoli, docked in Savannah, and all of Gaddafi's weapons of mass destruction are now in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. We continued to represent Gaddafi, hoping that we could integrate him into, you know, a civilized nation, only to find out that he was anxious to bring back to Libya the Pan Am 103 bomber. You probably remember that plane that was blown up over Scotland and killed, you know, 100 Americans. And we told him in no uncertain terms, look, you've denied any culpability and you want to try to get this guy, this bomber back. And he said, yes. And we said, well, if you do that, you know, all of your goodwill is going to go out the window and we'll have to have nothing to do with you anymore. And so the next thing we knew, he had gotten him out of Scotland, and he and his son, Saif, that we had been working with, greeted him at the airport with hugs and kisses. And so we ended up firing the client, discontinuing our representation of Libya, but at least we were able to get all of his weapons of mass destruction out of his hands. Gaddafi, as you know, was murdered, as were his sons. Saif has survived, though, and is still in southeastern Libya and still would like to come back to power. So that's one thing you might continue to watch. The other thing I might mention is that when I was teenage Republican chairman in Anderson, Joe Wilson, now Congressman Joe Wilson, was teenage Republican chairman in Charleston, where he went to high school. We would meet in Columbia at state meetings, and that was during the time when the Klan was after my family. So I would come to Columbia and tell Joe about the cross that was burned in our yard and the threats on our lives, and he would just be aghast because nothing like that was occurring in Charleston. So that was the beginning of a lifelong friendship that I've had with Joe. He went to Washington and Lee University, but I was able to convince him to send 2 of his 4 boys to Clemson. And also now he has a grandson, Addison, who's a rising senior at Clemson. And we've continued to be very good friends, very close friends. And so that's been, and also one of our mutual friends, Rusty DePass, who's now in Columbia and an active Republican too. So it's, you know, it's created a lifelong friendship that's been fun.
I thank you so much for all of your time today.